places, everybody. And action.
It's time once again for the Hooked on Movies podcast. Today's movie is the 1992 boxing comedy drama Digstown, celebrating the acting career of Mr. Lou Gossett Jr., whom we lost this year. With me are Ken.
Dear Lord, please give us the strength and courage to tear this man from limb to limb.
And Ted.
You can't con a con man.
And I'm Eric. A hustler has to get out of town as quickly as he can, but a good con man, he doesn't have to leave until he wants to. And that's what this movie is, the big con. We're talking Digstown. Ken, give us a synopsis here of Digstown.
After being released from a Georgia prison, smooth-talking con man Gabriel Kane teams up with his partner in crime, Fitz, and they travel to remote Digstown. Upon arriving, Fitz and Kane bet the wealthiest resident, former boxing manager John Dion, that they know a guy who can beat Digstown's 10 best fighters in one day. After Kane reels in Honey Rory Palmer, an aging boxer and old acquaintance, the grift is on. And that's the end of the synopsis.
Ted, give us the particulars here of Digstown.
Okay, Digstown is directed by Michael Ritchie, a screenplay by Stephen McKay. It's based off of the novel The Digstown Ringers by Leonard Wise. It has a running time of 98 minutes. It was released August 14th, 1992. It has a budget of $17 million. It had a box office gross of $4.8 million.
Oh.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, the Rotten Tomatoes score, the critic's score is a 60%, so just under the certified fresh threshold. And an audience score of a 78%. And it has an IMDb rating of 6.9. Digstown stars James Woods as Gabriel Kane, Louis Gossett Jr. as Honey Roy Palmer, Bruce Dern as John Guillaume, Oliver Platt as Daniel Patrick O'Shannon, Fitzpatrick, Heather Graham as Emily Forrester, Randall Tex Cobb as Edward Wolfe Forrester, Thomas Wilson Brown as Robbie Guillaume, Wilhelm von Homburg as Charles Makem Diggs, and Jesus Christ himself, Jim Caviezel, as Billy Hargrove.
How about that?
How about that? Such a young role there. Him and Heather Graham.
And he's the one that uses the N-words.
I know, right? How about that?
That's not very Jesus-like of him.
No, no, not a prediction there, right? He just loses it. Cool.
He doesn't even look like himself in that.
No, he doesn't, man. He doesn't look. If you would have told me that was Jim Caviezel, I would have been like, what? No. Ken, tell us some of the production notes on this one.
So filming for Digstown took place in Montana, as well as Los Angeles and Sacramento. Wasn't done in the South at all.
Far from it.
I don't know if this is sad. I think this would make some of you probably throw up in your mouth a little bit. Heather Graham and James Wood briefly dated during the making of this movie, despite Woods being almost twice her age.
That was my next question. What was the age difference? Twice, huh?
Almost twice.
Yeah.
Wow. So at that particular time, so Heather Graham would have been 22 and James Woods would have been, 45.
Ooh. Ouch.
That's creepy.
Hey, Daddy.
A little creepy. A little
creepy, yeah.
The film was called Midnight Sting in overseas markets. It's probably a better name than Digstown, I guess.
It is a cool title.
Also, the lady that plays the wife to Louis Gossett Jr. in this movie is actually his wife at the time. So.
Yeah, was his real wife.
Was he divorced or did she die?
I think they eventually divorced, I think.
Okay. So it was his real wife, huh? So he really had growing pains at the house there.
Yeah, they divorced. This movie came out in 92. It's like, how dare you put me in this movie?
Wow. All right. Okay.
So, and some other things we'll just touch base on while we're discussing the film.
Sweet. Well, if we're talking about the first time we watched this movie, Ken, I watched this with you, a couple years ago?
Yes.
Because I never heard of this movie before, ever. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably going to be in the same boat, seeing that it only brought in $4 million. Was it at the theater, first run theater?
Yes, it was a first run theater.
Oh, I'm sure it was, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I mean, with a cast like this, I think it would be, but I wasn't sure if it went straight to video.
It's just one of those 90s movies they cranked out, and it just didn't catch on with audiences right away, and then pretty much probably went straight to like video and cable, which of course is the first time I saw it was on cable. I can't tell you probably what year, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was like 94, 95, somewhere in that area.
And Ted, I believe your first time is this week.
It was.
But so we are very interested to find out what your thoughts are at the end of the podcast.
The interesting thing is, though, is I remember walking through the video stores that I would frequent and always having this in my hand, but for whatever reason, never rented it.
How many movies did you have in your hand? Quite a few.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You first had to go to the back room to get those movies first.
Yeah, right.
Behind the beaded curtain, of course.
Sorry, sorry, sir, but you reached your 10 limits of those movies. So
yeah.
Well, move on. I mean, when you're under 18 and you're back there, you're not supposed to be. But
naughty, naughty.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's always one of those movies is because I like the cast. I don't know why I didn't ever watch it.
Yeah, it's a great cast, but I honestly, Ken, I'd never heard of the movie before you brought it to my attention. Never
what
heard of
it. Was, I, of course, I'm a big boxing fan, and I also like a good heist con movie. So these kind of always kind of like a marriage for me to be interested in it.
Kind of slipped under the radar for me.
Practically, I watched every movie that came out on cable in the 90s. So,
well, sure. So there's probably a lot of stuff that you've seen that I have not seen, I'm sure.
There's things that I've seen that I wish I could unseen. So.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Quite Teddy a few, Shack actually. Too? Yeah. Oh, my God.
Every John Wayne movie?
Now, stop it.
No. Hey. You've gone too far.
You've gone too far. You've crossed the line. Yes.
Nope.
Bruce Dern reference. Bruce Dern was in the Cowboys with John Wayne.
Yeah. That's why I have a hard time rooting for Mr. Bruce Dern in any movie that he's a bad guy in. Because he's a hero. Because he actually shot John Wayne.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't seen the Cowboys, Ted just ruined it for
you. Spoiler alert.
But you had a good almost 60 years to watch that movie. So.
If you've been under a rock since 1967, that's fine. But
Bruce Dern is the hero of the movie The Cowboys.
Well, Ken, before we get off on a John Wayne hatred tangent here, let's talk about part one of Digstown.
Gabriel Kane, a con man, is released from prison in Winfield, Georgia, and immediately gets to work on his next scam. Kane and his partner, Fitz, travels to a small town not far from the prison, Digstown, a city obsessed with boxing. A mean-spirited man named John Guillaume owns almost all of Digstown. He is feared by many, but also respected because he is the former manager of Digstown's Pride and Joy, the once famous boxer, Charles Makeham Diggs, the man from whom the town is named. Upon hearing a remark that Diggs once knocked out 5 fighters in 1 day, Fitz says he knows of a fighter who could knock out any 10 in 1 day, which that boxer would be Honey Roy Palmer. Guillaume tries to take advantage of the situation and bets Fitz $100,000 to his $10,000 that no one man can beat 10 of Digstown's boxers in 1 day. Kane quickly volunteers to finance Fitz's bet, and the con is on. Kane seeks out an old buddy, Palmer, who is now 48 years old and is a YMCA supervisor teaching kids boxing. After some initial reluctance, Palmer agrees to participate and starts to train for the fight. Kane and Guillaume agree to various conditions of the bet, with 1 day being a full 24 hours, and Digstown fighters being able to come from anywhere surrounding Oliver County. A loan shark backs Kane's bet. I don't know if he's really a loan shark. I would say he's a mobster. With the understanding that his health and welfare will be riding on the outcome. In other words, if he doesn't pay up, he dies. Kane discovers that Guillaume's treachery goes deeper than Digstown people know. As he was the manager for Charles Makeham Diggs, Guillaume drugged Diggs during a fight so Guillaume could collect on the opponent's long odds. Diggs suffered irreversible brain damage as a result. His prison buddy, Sister, is learned that Guillaume has more than $1.5 million in assets. Kane tricks him into risking all of it. Now it's up to Honey Roy Palmer to defeat all 10 of Digstown's men. And that's the end of part one of Digstown.
That's pretty much the whole movie.
That's pretty much the whole movie.
I know, it's related to the fights. The fights.
Then you go boxer to boxer to boxer, yeah.
The fights actually take a pretty good chunk of this movie out, too.
That's true. It does take up to like the last second half of the movie. Okay. So like we were talking about earlier, as the movie opens, James Woods' character is in jail, and I guess he's kind of like a big shot in jail, kind of. Can we say that?
Well, he's the man that can get things done. He's not Morgan Freeman from Shawshank Redemption, but he offers something that even he couldn't offer them in prison, and that's an escape route. So,
yes,
as the warden says, since he's been there, in the history of that prison, they've only had four escapes, and three of them have been since he's been there. So,
or some number like that. Yeah.
I like the fact that when he's sitting there with him, with the warden, he's just kind of like, don't take it as an oppression against you, right? They just go back and forth with these like jabs at each other.
Got the loaded gun there, just playing with him.
Yeah, and actually then shoots the gun. After the first one, actually just doesn't go off. And then he makes that comment about blanks.
Yeah. Yes.
But it actually starts off with the fight.
It does. First fight
between two other prisoners. One's having to be Gabriel's friend.
So is that fight staged so they can do the escape?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Fight stage. So he allows him to fight the other fighter, so as a distraction to get that other guy out.
Right.
You know.
Is it also staged, though, to set up the end of the movie?
It is, but I didn't want to get too far into it and give it all away all at the beginning. But thank you, Ted, for doing that.
No problem.
And that's Digstown. What are we seeing next week? Yeah.
You know, we're not led to believe that that's the situation. We're led to believe that this is a real fight. But somehow he got on the other fighter's bad side. And so to have this distraction. Because I guess the prisoner that he got out, we don't know much about him. I mean, for all we know, this guy could have been guilty of child pornography. I don't know. But it gives him 10 to sneak him out. He is a little bit of a weasel. I mean, he is a kind of a dick. He's supposed to be a very unlikable character, I guess. But I thought it was interesting that they blindfolded him and that they put the money on the back and put it back in the cigarette case.
He's away.
Put it on his back. He's put the money on the back, so the guy on the other side, he's been collecting money. In fact, Oliver Platt and him talk about it in the next scene, about leave it to him to make 50 Gs in the house. Maybe it was maybe four or five guys, because how are you going to make 50 Gs? And that comes with one of the Eric's lines that he brought up about a good con man can stay as long as he wants. Nice little interaction there between Oliver Platt and James Woods. And me and Ted were talking about Oliver Platt offline just yesterday, I believe. And we were talking about how underrated of an actor Oliver Platt is. He's very also enjoyable in this movie. But he's got a very long list of things that he's been in.
He's never really a leading man.
Never a leading man, but he does have... There's a movie called The Infiltrator, which he plays I believe he plays some type of journalist that goes undercover to show that the Nazi party is still alive and well. It's like in the 90s. It's a pretty interesting movie. I would, you know, if you could find it, check it out. But he's also done other things, Flatliners, Three Musketeers. Now, there's a lot of guilty pleasures. I mean, I would tell you he's not in a lot of awesome movies, but a lot of guilty pleasures for me. Three to Tango is one of those, and Ready to Rumble is one of those. And he also showed up as a lawyer in The West Wing.
Very good in The West Wing TV show.
He's also very good in A Time to Kill, too.
Yeah, he is, actually. Yes, Time to Kill is very good.
I think he has one of those every man look. He doesn't have a movie star look. He has that next door neighbor look. I think he's very relatable. I love the fact that he's trying to con the guys at the bar and pool and playing cards. And he does it by not conning them at all. He tells them he's going to win. He tells them he's going to do it. The only thing he cons in that situation is he's taken some type of pill that will not allow him to get drunk when he's drinking all that beer.
But just a hangover kicks in.
The hangover kicks
in. But yeah, so he's acting, saying that he's drunk and shit-faced and stuff. But yeah, I mean, he's conning them. But, you know, honestly, he told them up front, hey, I'm going to take your money playing cards. You invited me. I didn't con myself into this game. So he conned them. But
he's cheating at cards, though, right?
No, I don't think he's cheating.
I think it's got to be.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
James Woods shows him palming an ace.
He actually palms the queen before he palms the ace. So
yeah, there's no way he'd win all those games. But what about pool, though? He's just a natural pool shark.
That one's more difficult to con. I mean, the other guy, he's good. I mean, it's not like he was going up against somebody that was like mediocre. He was risking a lot of money there. He was risking the whole con right there on a pool game.
Yeah, he's Paul Newman in The Hustler, pretty much.
But I'm surprised the locals didn't just like beat the hell out of him more. He turns over the keys like fine, and then he kind of, you know, you start making fun of the man on the poster, then the blood starts to boil, right?
These locals are not likable at all. No, I mean, I wish they had likable locals at least.
They're
right?
A bunch of rednecks.
Yeah,
bunch
what
of
you rednecks.
But you should have at least one or two that are like sensible, right? That are like
no.
They've got
all.
A Confederate flag hanging up in their barn.
It's a bunch of redneck hillbillies. I expected someone to pull a knife and stab them. To be honest with you,
actually, Guion's son is probably the one guy that might be okay. We don't know about that at the beginning, but I think towards the end we get to see a little bit more. But the fact that he's okay with risking that new Corvette that he just got from his dad.
The 58 vet convertible?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. My dad could give me something that's worth $20. If I gamble that away, I'm going to be scared that my dad's going to give me shit.
Yeah.
I just bought you that. And that's $20. And this thing's $25,000. You know, it's probably more. It's
off,
a Corvette.
It's worth a hell of a lot more than 25. Grand. Yeah.
Even for 92, it's got to be worth more than $50,000.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
It's fully restored too.
It's a sweet looking car. It's a very
much so.
Very sweet looking. I mentioned this before. I drove a 72 Corvette, and that was back in 97. And I think the value of that was like somewhere around close to $30,000. This is kind of
discrepancy. Ken did not own a 72 Corvette.
I did not own it. I worked for a radio station that it was a prize for their 25th anniversary. They were working
with the dealership.
You guys
gave away a 72 Vet? Seriously?
Yeah, there was a 72 Vet that they were giving away. It was in conjunction with the dealership. So
still,
the dealership
that's
was
a nice,
part of
nice
it.
Prize.
And I think you had to go to the dealership to actually register to win. So I think that's what they were trying to get business in for.
But you as an employee were not eligible.
So. I guess not. No. But I got to drive it.
That's
drive
cool.
It down 355, and I was nervous as heck because I did not want to crash a 72 Corvette.
Automatic or stick? I assume auto?
It was automatic, actually.
Yeah, 72 Vets auto, yeah. Still, that's pretty sweet ride. Yeah.
I'd have gotten in trouble.
Oh, gosh. Ted never came back.
Yeah, I would have never come back, or I'd have gotten at least 2 speeding tickets.
The only Vet I've ever driven, just a memory that's sketched in my mind here. So I was 10, mind you. I was not driving the car by myself.
You drove a Vet at age 10?
I was not by myself. My neighbor had a 70. No, my
friend who was 8 years old was in the car with him.
So I'm 10. Our neighbor had a 79 Corvette. I remember this. This is just a weird memory. So 79 Corvette, he's got the tape deck. No, you know what? No, correction. I'm sorry.
A-track tape?
No, 81 Corvette. Because that was the model year change was right around 82. It was an 81 Vet. And I remember he had the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack in the car.
Oh, my God.
Just jamming to that. And I'm driving this car just kind of up and down the neighborhood. Okay. Never driven a car in my life. First time.
I would hope not. I mean, 10 years old.
Right. It puts me in an 81 Corvette. So I'm riding the brake as I'm riding the gas.
How are you tall enough to see over the steering wheel?
Vets are pretty low to the
ground. I mean, you barely are
tall
enough to see over the steering wheel now. How the heck do you see it back then?
I was 5'5 when I was 10 years old. So,
okay.
Yeah. I'm driving this Vet just up at residential. You know, we're not doing more than like 5 or 10 miles an hour, let's be honest. I remember I'm riding the brake as I'm riding the gas, and you could just smell the brake pads burning. And he's like, all right, that's it. Pull over. We're done. So,
yeah.
Didn't have the thrill that Ken had driving it down the interstate.
Yeah, no crap.
I was happy and nervous all at one time.
I am at my midlife crisis, 50 years old in June, couple months, I turned 50.
Yeah.
What do? Do I buy a Vet?
Yeah.
Do I go through a divorce? Do I quit my job? What do I do? All three?
Hopefully the one was choices are not a real option, hopefully, but okay.
Well, those are your stereotypical midlife crisis, right? You get divorced.
Buy a Vet.
Get a mistress, buy a Corvette, quit your job. I don't know.
I'm thinking about buying a grill. So there you go. I guess I aim low.
But you're buying the Corvette of grills.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Just say that. All right. So
it's like High Life. What is the High Life beer? It's like the.
Oh, my God. Yeah. The champagne of beers.
The champagne of beers.
Dude, it's warm urine. It's horrible. Don't get me started on Miller High Life. Vile beer.
It is not good. That's for sure.
It is not good indeed. All right, but we're getting off topic here on vets and beer. Let's get back into Digstown.
Bruce Dern is just a great bad guy.
He is.
Except just, in the Cowboys.
Oh, gosh.
Right in this movie, he is a great bad guy. He really is. He's subtle bad guy. You know he's kind of like the guy who's running the town. You don't hate him altogether yet. You will towards the end of the movie.
Right.
But right now, he's kind of got that southern charm. They kind of, you know, him and Wood's character banter back and forth in that kind of southern drawl, gentleman bet kind of thing.
His last name, Guillaume. It sounds Louisiana-ish.
Yeah, like French Creole.
French. I don't know exactly. You can't really place where Digstown is located in Georgia. I would assume it would be closer to the Gulf region around Alabama.
It's sure as hell not Metro Atlanta. We know that.
No.
Probably it's close to Florida, close to state line. Yeah, it's rural.
Bruce Dern's a hell of an actor.
He is.
I don't know why he ever kind of disappeared for quite a while until the movie Nebraska, which is an awesome movie.
Brilliant movie.
It's just amazing.
And his daughter, Laura Dern, is a great actress.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the blood.
And, of course, he was really great in The Hateful Eight.
He was, yes.
Yeah, as the Confederate general, yeah. He's just an amazing actor. And he has that southern slime ball.
Yes, he does.
Feel to him. Like,
kind of,
you know,
like, you know what he reminds me of? He reminds me of Ned Beatty's character in Gator.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever seen those Burt Reynolds flicks where Ned Beatty's a sheriff, he kind of has that greaseball southern Ghana. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll actually say that didn't really disappear. His movie roles were just not as prolific. He is acting a lot in the 90s and the 2000s.
He's up there in age, isn't he?
Yeah, he's definitely up there in age, and I think that's what it is. I think he's got up to the point where the characters that he played in the 60s and the 70s, the first time I think I saw him was in one of my favorite Westerns called Support Your Local Sheriff with James Garner.
Sure.
You know, but he's doing these weird 90s movie roles. I mean, around this time, he's doing Down Periscope with Kelsey Grammer.
So sorry.
Oh, dear God.
I love
that movie. I do love that movie.
It's a guilty pleasure.
But, you know, he's doing movies like Small Soldiers and Last Man Standing. And
he was in Small Soldiers?
He was one of the voice actors.
Okay.
He was a small soldier.
A little bit of that. So he did necessary stop acting. The roles were just kind of lower key for sure. Yeah, he's brilliant actor. He makes this role. It could easily be a role that is forgettable, and he won the
Academy Award for Nebraska, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Did he get Best Actor?
Yeah, I believe so.
I believe he did, yes.
But you got to like him and James Woods. We talked about this in The Shawshank, and this movie's not Shawshank. No way is it Shawshank. But there is a chess game going on in this movie right off the bat.
A little bit, right? Yep.
Gabriel comes in, and he brings the same car, basically, that Guillaume owns, and parks it in his spot,
right?
And then sits in his spot. Staring the flame, and then he's going to add more and more gasoline to the flame to see what happens. And we get to see right there in that first instance, that first meetup when they're watching boxing, and they make that first bet that Guillaume, he owns this town. He gets up and tells a boxer that he's taking a dive. And so right there and then, you know who's in charge and what happens here. Makes you wonder about the background that you got. I mean, it's interesting about these characters. You know, you have one of the guys, the one with the hat, the one that introduces Fitz to everybody. We find out later on that he's part of the con, right? So I figure they must get a lot of information from him. Because I don't know how much information they actually get from Wolf, who's the prisoner that had that fight at the beginning that we talked about. I think that other guy is kind of probably giving information like how he runs the town, that he makes people throw fights and things of that nature.
You get the fact that the con is a lot deeper than what you know at the beginning. That's where it differs from a movie like The Sting, where in The Sting, you watch them develop the cons. Whereas here, you kind of get pieces of the con as you're going forward. You're like, oh, okay, so this guy's involved. It's interesting how they set it up. And James Woods is good here as well. He plays a good con man here.
I know that's hard for you to say there, today.
It is, because he's kind of lost his mind in the last few years.
Okay, he's gone off the deep end lately. That's just saying it mildly. But let's talk about how he used to be.
He was always kind of an odd duck.
I mean, he's one of my favorite movies, Against All Odds.
He was really good in Casino.
Sure. He was.
He's a good actor. For me, he's that one of those actors that, okay, here and there I see movies that I like him in general, though he doesn't do much for me. And he plays the doctor in
Any Given Sunday. And he's good in that. He's really good in that.
But also it's just replaceable. The other movie that I like him in, which is another guilty pleasure, is The Hard Way with Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
Where he plays a cop that has to take on an actor as his partner. It's those 90s cheesy, roles that we get to see. And this kind of movie kind of fits that.
Very much so.
He does a good job here, though. They do play off each other very well. They kind of respect each other of being con men. So I do think that, Guion is careful. He's trying to be careful against someone like him because he could see that he has already planned something here and he's trying to strategize against him here. But then you also have the relationship between Louis Gossett Jr. and James Woods, which is also a very believable relationship. I believe they have been in another movie together, but I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But anyway, I do think it's funny that he basically tells Fitz that Palmer's not in. That he has to go get him. It's like, why do you have to go get him? He isn't coming if he doesn't know he's coming. So even with each other, they're kind of conning each other within the con, which I always think is kind of fun. It's a throwback to a little bit of The Sting. You don't give everybody 100% information about what's going on, even to your partners, because there are some things you have to keep close to the chest, which I think is kind of cool, especially when you see it in a movie.
And this movie does a good job of doing that.
It does. It makes you wonder what exactly happened in Moline, how that all went south, because it seems like that it went into business for himself and was getting himself purposefully beat up. And James Woods took it seriously and threw in the towel. But yeah, I like their relationship. And Louis Gossett Jr., he's a good actor as well. He's not on board. And he's like, damn it, I'm on board.
Right.
Yeah.
Pick me up at 8.
Pick me right. up. Yeah.
I think it's important, though, that they established that something like Moline happened. We have to show that they care for each other. The con is important, but at the end of the day, they care about each other more than the money. They care each other more than the con.
And we realize that in the second half of this movie, where now it starts to really get personal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's not to, go too far, but the veil of the con, and this is where, because it's boxing, it's a combat sport, people are really getting hurt. That's where the veil of the con really disappears. It's no longer a secret that there's a con going on. They can only keep that up for so long. Once the actual fighting starts, now it's game on.
It's con versus con.
Well, you could actually argue that everybody knows that there's con going on. There's no secret to this.
I think Guillaume definitely suspects that there's a con going on.
Well, of course he does.
But he's not 100% for sure on board.
I think he's about 98% sure that there's a con.
Yeah.
He is up for the game. I think he wants somebody to take him on. I think he thinks
he's the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah, he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. And I think he's bored. I think he wants another challenge. It's probably been since
he took over the town.
When with Charles Makeham Diggs, he had to drug him to lose that fight. He had to, make things happen to get where he's at. And, he's, like I said, everybody falls in line with him now in the town. And if they don't fall in line with him, he sends them to prison or they end up dead or both. We see it with Wolf. He was in prison and then gets killed and comes back. And that brings us to Emily. Emily even knows that there's this con. She comes in and sees him, playing with the dogs. And she's like, oh, you must know my brother. Because she knows that they would attack him. And the whole town is talking about you and your friend. And then it's like, oh, I just met that guy. Okay, yeah, the whole town is talking about it. Everybody knows, not just Guillaume. That there's a con, both sides know. It's interesting to see where the town falls on that. Because we mentioned earlier about Fitz talking bad about Charles Makeham Diggs, but at the same time, they must not like Guion for taking
but he,
all
but
their
he's doing,
land.
He's obviously doing that on purpose as part
well,
of the
Well, nobody
con.
Knows that he drugged Diggs.
Right. But he knows he took everybody's land.
But Wolf found it out.
Wolf found out. That's why he ended up in jail.
That's why he's dead.
Saying that when they find him dead and she runs away, that not one person besides Gabriel goes after her. Nobody checks on her to see how she's doing. Some stranger that nobody really knows runs after her to see how she's doing. I think it's kind of weird. And then, of course, they have that big funeral. There's nobody from the town. It's just the gospel singers and them, it looks
like. Well, sure.
Here's the thing. I mean, I'm a big Heather Graham fan here in the 90s. I have a huge, huge crush on Heather Graham in the 90s. But
Did you like Heather Graham in The Hangover? I'm sure you did.
I'm sure I did, too. But maybe even more so, Boogie Nights.
That's the first role I ever knew her in.
I knew her in some other roles before this because she had kind of like a teenage actress.
I was shocked when I found out she was in this movie.
Yeah?
License to Drive was the first movie
I saw. I love License to Drive, yes, with the Coreys.
Yeah, she played a character called Mercedes.
Mercedes Lane. Yeah.
That was probably the first movie I saw her with.
Mercedes Lane.
So I knew who she was going into this movie. To this movie, she has some really nice roles. She is also somebody that seems to have disappeared a little bit off the face of the earth now. But back then in the 90s, she was my hit girl. She was at least, you know, top three because she's roughly my age. She might be a year older than me. Yeah, she's a year and a half older than me. She's okay here, but
there's not much to her character.
They try to give some type of love interest. You could see that he's kind of smitten by her. Just like their relationship, it just doesn't, it kind of icky. A little bit, right?
A little bit.
And I mean, if she's 22 years old at this particular time, and the actor who played Wolf, which is Randall Cobb, I think goes by Tex Cobb, which he's also in a lot of 80s movies.
I think so many of them.
But he was actually a boxer himself. But he's been in movies like Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. He's the one that steals the puppy at the beginning of the movie, and Ace has to get him. But he's been in a lot of movies. Liar, Liar.
Wasn't he in Raising Arizona? Am I thinking of the right guy? The same guy he played the motorcycle guy in Raising Arizona?
I don't think he played the motorcycle guy in Raising Arizona. No.
Looks like him.
I can understand why you think that might be him.
Okay.
Other movies like Critical Condition with Richard Pryor.
Doctor's going to make it all better.
But the one that I remember most from is Naked Gun 33 and a Third when Frank Drebin goes to prison undercover.
Yeah.
And they're all in the shower and stuff like that. He's like, would you pick that up for me, lover? He's a nice character actor. He doesn't have any great acting chops, but he's... Actually, I think he does really good here, especially at the beginning of the movie, because by the middle of the movie, he's dead. So I guess...
Right. Spoiler alert.
As far as Emily goes, one of those characters that if you took her out, it wouldn't change the film. She's nice to look at. And I guess you do need somebody to play that part. So if you're going to get somebody to play that part, it might as well be Heather Graham.
Sure.
Anything else on part one you guys want to talk about?
I mean, we could talk about briefly the buildup of the con. One of the things that intrigues me about this movie is how early on after Fitz's winning at pool and cards, the start of the con, obviously, where you're kind of baiting everyone in. I like the movie itself, how it's building up, not directly. You're just getting kind of like little glimpses and little pieces, and you're not exactly sure. The only thing you know is that like every 5 minutes, these guys are doubling and doubling and doubling the bet because it says egos on egos. You think it's going to be okay. He's got to outlast these 10 guys, but you know that's not the way it's going down. Can't be that easy, right?
Right.
Well, I think it's kind of weird. It starts off with a $10,000 to $100,000 bet.
Yeah, that's a pretty big spread.
Yeah, that's ridiculousness.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to make that bet.
No.
And I love how he just assumes that Fitz being a shark or a commie has got $50,000 on him at any given time. I'm like, whatever.
Well, they probably believe that he might be drunk and they're trying to take advantage of him. Even though he's saying that he's probably conning all of them, he figures they could take advantage of him because he's drunk.
Maybe. Sure.
I don't know. It kind of just weirds me that $10,000 to $100,000 bet. I don't know. If it was $10,000 to $50,000, then maybe I would be like, okay. But that just seemed like too big of a discrepancy to start off the betting.
Does seem a little extreme. I agree.
Now, if it was bet $10,000 to win, that's a whole different issue. But Bruce Dern is asking Fitz to put up the $100,000, and he's only going to bet 10. That's a ridiculous bet for Fitz to take. I mean, if there was a point where it's like, okay, there's a con going on, it's right there. Because who takes that bet?
That's because I don't believe that Guillaume respects Fitz. He doesn't see him as any type of threat. But when he gets to Gabriel, it's on equal terms because he realizes that Gabriel is the mastermind behind all this.
Yeah.
He's the guy that go up against.
And you got the legitimacy of the backing mobsters or the throwing names out there of people you know that can handle the money.
Right.
Yeah, they're definitely mobsters. I mean,
there's something.
Loan sharks don't live in that type of house. That's a really, really nice house, and you have a guy right there that's your enforcer.
We were trying to figure out what their nationality was.
Yeah, it's hard to really tell because his son, the gangster's son, is definitely not Italian.
No,
Cuban,
maybe. Colombian. Being that it's the late, we're talking late '80s into the '90s. I'm going to assume probably he's Colombian.
I'm going to say
that would make
Cuban
sense.
Just because of how many people came over from Cuba, in the 60s, 70s. And I'm thinking he's probably one of those kind of people that kind of did that. That came over and built a new life for himself as a loan shark, as a mobster.
All right, Scarface.
Yeah, right.
Say hello to my little friend. It's a throwaway character. I mean, the guy.
He hardly ever speaks.
Yeah. I hate to kill my friends. You need the character to have that money backing. So he's there for just being there. But I like how then everything kind of like falls into place. You have to go get Roy. You have to fix the fight details and listening to them to arguing about ounces of gloves and how many rounds and when to start the fight and who could fight.
What time, who could have helmets on.
Well, it's positioning again. It's all these little chess moves that we talked about earlier. Even though Gabriel says at the end of that he doesn't believe that he'll bring in somebody to...
A ringer
to bring in. He knows he's got a ringer. But he's pretending like that he's got one over on him. He wants to show Guillaume, make it look like that he has the upper hand because then Guillaume will let his guard down. He'll think that he's overconfident or something like that. So I do like the little setup and these little moves here and there. I don't know if I believe that with Emily, with her brother dying and then him explaining about everything right there and then, and all of a sudden she like buys into it all, right?
There's some ridiculous moments.
That's a little bit. You have to move the movie along. And that's one good thing about this movie too, is the pace of the movie is good. It's only an hour and 38 minutes, I think.
Yeah, the timing on this is perfect. It's great. Yeah.
It does sacrifice some plot holes and some like ridiculousness. But it does it into for the purpose of pace. And I think that's a good thing.
We go into section two, part two?
You betcha.
Yes.
Let's do it.
Part two is basically the fight.
Yeah.
So he fights a guy named Buck Holland, who is actually formerly played by a heavyweight boxing contender himself called Rocky Papali. I'm not sure who he was. I never really knew him outside of this movie. So one of these days, I guess I'll have to check that out. And then he fights Slim Busby, who has been bribed by King to take a dive. And then he fights Billy Hargrove, who is easily beaten. And then you have Sam Lester, who is secretly given a laxative before the fight. And eventually he runs from the ring. He just can't control some of his bodily functions.
He shits himself in the ring.
to put it bluntly, yes. And then you have Hambone Busby, who's the brother of Slim. They were both bribed to take a dive, but Guillaume kind of found out because Slim hid the money in a place that was easily found and basically told Hambone that unless he's victorious in the ring, his brother's going to die. And of course, he did end up losing.
I think he killed his brother regardless.
Probably.
Yep, I think he killed him whether he won or not.
Let's let Ken finish the synopsis first.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, that's okay. So after Slim is killed, Palmer is enraged, and in his next fight with Sonny Hawkins, who is easily dispatched, Robbie Guillaume, the son of Guillaume, approaches the next ring, but then backs out under instructions from his father, so he doesn't even enter the ring. His cowardice is regarded as a forfeit. Frank Mangrum officially loses by disqualification after kicking Palmer in the groin, then hitting the referee, and then gets knocked out by Palmer. Tank Miller, a gargantuan type of fighter, puts up a good fight, but a tiring Palmer eventually beats him. That brings up Dickstown's best man, which is really not a Dickstown man, Hammerhead Hagen, the only fighter ever to beat Palmer during their professional careers. He's brought in as a surprise ringer. Gion moved him in a county resident just before the bet rules were established, meaning that Hagen can legally fight. The bout is one-sided. Palmer looks done for, but he gets new motivation after seeing Diggs, who is sitting ringside, move his hands slightly, which he interprets as a show of support. Kane, not wanting to see his friend die, attempts to throw in the towel, but Palmer catches it and throws it back. Palmer then rallies to knock out his opponent. Then Palmer, Kane, and Fitz begin the celebration of this miraculous feat, but their celebration is cut short by Gion, who notes that his son never entered the ring, therefore only 9 fights have been transpired. The true 10th fighter is then introduced as Meniso Torres, a tough-as-nails boxer who ruled the boxing underground in prison, from which Kane was recently released. That's the fighter we saw beat up on Wolf at the beginning of the movie. No one has ever defeated him, and Guillaume admonishes Kane with, "Never try to hustle a hustler." An exhausted Palmer is no match for Torres, but just when all looks lost, Kane whistles at Torres, gets his attention, straightens his tie, and does a thumb-down gesture, copying a move Gion did earlier. Torres drops his gloves and invites Palmer to hit him, hitting the canvas, knocked out. Kane was expecting such a trick from Gion and bribed Torres long ago for a moment like this. Gion has lost everything, leading Kane to correct him with the admonishment. Actually, I believe it goes, "Never con a con man, especially one who's better than you are." Calm at first, he snaps and pulls a gun. His son Robbie tries to intervene, and Gion smacks him. Palmer then grabs Gion and prepares to deck him, but instead he turns to Hambone, claiming, "My hands hurt. You want to do this?" Hambone gladly obliges and delivers Gion a powerful knockout blow. Kane congratulates Palmer. "What you did," he says, "couldn't be done." To which Palmer replies, "Now you motivate me." That's the end of Dickstown.
Ken, were you upset that all that popcorn got damaged?
Yes, I was like, man, not the popcorn.
Not the popcorn, no.
I go to places like that for popcorn. If anything else is there and I can enjoy it, that's great. I love
it. Really, that's what I was thinking when he decked him into the popcorn. I'm like, oh, Ken ain't going to like that.
I think it's interesting to take a look at each fight and just really go with each one. And we didn't really talk about the training that much.
It was definitely Rocky IV style training.
It was really bad.
I don't think
Let's
it was
be
bad.
Perfectly honest. It was bad.
How was it bad?
It was just him running all over the place.
It was completely unnecessary.
I do like the scene where he's with Gabriel and he's finding out about how Diggs was, how he lost the fight.
Right. That's the only thing we really need from that entire sequence.
Right.
We don't need him seeing Dig in his wheelchair. We don't need any of that baloney. Get him into the ring. Yes, boxing's huge around Diggs, around this town and everything, but you know these guys don't stand a snowball's chance in holy hell against somebody who is a legitimate fighter.
Question for you guys here, because I'm kind of confused here of the timeline a little bit.
Answer.
That he goes visits Diggs at his home.
His run-down home, apparently.
Right, it's really run down. How long ago do you think this fight was, you know, that he got his brain damage from?
I'd say a couple years.
See, that's the thing.
Not recent history.
I think it's more than that.
That's what my problem is.
He looks so old.
Because he looks so old. But then we also see...
And Bruce Dern's character's old, too.
Well, he is old, but then we think about Wolf, and Wolf is in prison for what he knows. When did he know it? When did he find out? Because Wolf is talking about his dogs. It can't be that long ago because
the dogs would be dead.
Dogs would be dead. I'm thinking within a few years. But
when did he know, and who knew it?
Right.
James Woods says he overheard a conversation. It could have conceivably have been any time. I mean, it's been a few years because Bruce Dern holds control over the town.
Right.
And has for quite a while. That's not the issue. I mean,
I don't think the training montage is that bad either, because it's short. It's not very long.
It doesn't need to be there.
I mean, the training is for a week. It's not like you're going to do some serious training. I mean, all you're going to be doing is some running and some light boxing. You're not going to be sparring up to a week of the fight.
You're not climbing a mountain.
Right. You're not climbing a mountain like in Rocky IV. In fact, I appreciate this boxing much more than I did Rocky IV, almost all the Rocky movies. The boxing here in this movie is actually feels more real. It feels legitimate boxing. It has a really good real feel. Well, it doesn't feel like anybody's pulling punches. It looks like they're actually hitting each other. It's not like Rocky IV, where Rocky misses him by 6-8 inches and Drago gets a black eye. It's better boxing. This is an underrated boxing movie, I think, because I think there's some real good realism in this. And I think the fact that you're doing it with people that are actually, this is not like for the heavyweight championship of the world. This is actually just local boxing, which I think gives it kind of an edge over these other movies that are for the heavyweight championship of the world, because they don't have to be like, look professional.
He's the greatest guy who never was.
And that's the other thing. It kind of reminds me of wrestling's local circuits that we've talked about. This reminds me of just local boxing. People are considered gods in counties because they can box or they can wrestle or they could just do, certain things that other people can't within a certain radius of a certain area. But I like this, movie. In the first bout, it looks like he's going to win easily. But then he kind of steps off the gas for the betting on the side. So you have all these little side bets that Fitz is trying to get on the side. I'm not sure how I feel about that you're trying to make money off of the townspeople that are already poor to begin with. Are you nickeling and diming all these guys? You're counting the town out of their own money.
There's going to be betting in the stands regardless. So, come on.
Hopefully it's not much. Hopefully it's kind of just, it's probably low.
It's always, he always says it's like bet 40 to win 80 or bet 20 to win 100 they're just nickel and diming in the stands.
They were accused of that by Emily earlier in the movie because he's like, what do you think? I'm just trying to nickel and dime. And she goes, I don't know what you're trying to do. But then he ends up winning that fight. And then the next fight, the guy is bribed and doesn't know how to take a dive. He just runs around the ring throughout the whole time.
Right. And this is where the veil starts to really start to come down on the con. This kid takes a dive for $5,000. And actually, he makes it
for $2,500 a piece, actually, because him and his brother both take it.
So it's not good. He doesn't know what he's doing, and he ends up taking a dive. And it's pretty obvious that he's taking a dive. Then we have the next guy, Palmer, takes care of him. You talk about the training montage real quick. The best part of it is when Louis Gossett Jr. finally shaves his head and he doesn't have that annoying George Jefferson haircut.
Yeah.
That is very distracting and very unbecoming.
It's definitely not his
look. Wait for him to do the funky chicken?
I wanted to hear Burning Heart as he's like, in the Burning Heart.
Then we get to the fourth fight. And the fourth fight is with the second guy's brother, the Busby twins, or the Busby brothers.
The fourth fight is actually the laxative.
Oh, yeah, the guy that shits his pants. And in this, up until this point, this is fun. It's that there's a lot of fun. Even the guy who doesn't know how to take a dive, we know he's taking a dive. It's all fun and games at that point. Okay, so before we go and get into it, the guy who plays the older Busby brother is actually, he plays Alvin Mack in The Program.
Yeah. Which James, is awesome. Is James Woods in that?
No, that's okay. James Caan.
James Caan, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
the different James.
Where the kids are lying in the street and letting cars go over them?
You've never seen that scene since a bunch of idiots decided to do it in real life.
Well, right. But originally when the movie came out, that was in there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he plays the Alvin Mack, the linebacker who gets his knee blown out.
Isn't a lot of movies like that, though.
I was surprised to see how many movies he was actually really in. Okay, this is where my biggest problem with Dickstown. They bring the elder Busby brother in to the locker room. He finds his brother hanging from ceiling with a stool underneath him. And Guillaume, I guess, is one of his lackeys, has found the money that Cain given them. He threatens him that he's going to kill his brother if he doesn't win. Guillaume knows that he's probably going to get knocked out. Let's be perfectly honest. He's watched Palmer fight. This is going to be his fifth fight. He sees what kind of punches he has. He knows this kid has no chance of actually winning the fight. And the way he talks to him.
Put a little fire under his ass, right?
Yeah, the way he talks to him, it's extremely racist. And I mean, the movie takes a dark turn. And this is the problem, because it doesn't pay off. I know that at the end of the movie, the older Busby brother punches Guillaume. Let's be honest. For what Guillaume did here, there should have been a much more severe retribution coming to him. They essentially lynched this kid because he took money. And they know that they can do it because they're rich and white, and he's black, and they're in Georgia. And Guillaume controls the town. The power dynamic is way too in one side's favor. The people who do what's bad don't really get what's coming to them. Because, yeah, he loses his money. He loses the property or whatever he loses. That's all well and good. He murdered somebody. And he did it in a very racist fashion by lynching him. And even in 92, that's a bad look. Okay, it's not good. I know what question Ken's going to ask. Well, what should he have done?
Yes.
You have the cops beat him up.
No, I agree with that.
You just beat him up.
If you were to kill them, how would you do it?
I wouldn't have put a lynching in the middle of the movie.
It's a little dark for this comedy drama.
First of all, is he the first person to get killed in this movie?
Well, no.
Hasn't it got dark already earlier on when her brother got killed?
No. Here's the thing. Then we find out that he knew the secret. And we know at that point that this is a kid. There's a huge difference in what you're talking about. Because the guy that's in prison is older.
Ted, it's a movie. Okay. Calm down, man. It's
10 years older. Yeah, I get it.
Well, but it's Ken's point here that's really annoyed me now.
All right.
Because that's bullshit.
But if you kill one guy, it's in his character. It's in his character to kill people off when they double-cross him.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. But this is a kid. That younger Busby brother can't be over. He can't be over 18. This movie takes a completely dark turn when we find him hanging.
Oh, he's over 18. He's got to be like 21, 22 years old. I mean, he's not a teenager.
He is not. If he's a day over 21, he's 35.
Okay. But it doesn't matter to a person like Guillaume how old he is. Yes, he does say some racist things.
It doesn't fit with the rest of the movie.
But it fits the character. The guy already killed a guy that ratted on him.
Ratting him out and knowing his secret is completely different than taking five to throw a fight. They don't equal up. You're completely wrong.
The guy caused brain damage to the guy at the beginning of the movie. He had another guy killed. What do you want him to do on this? Hey, don't ever do this again. I'm going to let you off with a warning. I agree with you that I think he should have just had the shit beat out of him and him end up being in the hospital. I don't think they should have killed him. I agree with you on that. However, it's in the character to kill people. Who's going to go against him? If he kills a person off, who's going to challenge it? He owns the police. Who's going to take him on? What do you think, Eric? Is it in this character to kill off people or not to kill off people?
It is in his character to kill off people. But for this movie, it is a really kind of a darker turn. Yeah, the warden probably killed off the guy in jail. They put whatever it was in the guy's nasal spray, the boxer, and brain damaged him. Guillaume clearly does not have a conscience. We know that. And will do anything to show his power and keep his power. And, you know, like a lot of people, shows of threats and killing off people, it shows that you are the strong man and do not cross me. It's like a Hugo Chavez from Mexico, if I'm thinking of the right drug lord, probably not. But it's fear that really keeps everyone in line. But this movie is so lighthearted almost and kind of willy-nilly, if you will, at parts when you throw in a scene of that caliber. Yeah, it's a little over the top. Did it really throw anything against me in the movie that changed my value or belief or rating or I was really passionate about it? No, not really. Maybe I'm just a cold, heartless bastard. Who knows?
No, it was already established that he's the strong man. we didn't need to see him lynch a kid. And
no, we didn't need to, but we did.
I mean,
prior to him lynching this kid and prior to him having the conversation with the brother, there was really no racial epithets to anyone.
That's why this is so
positive with the other boxers and really was getting behind them. And it was, you did not see that. And I think this is probably added in there to show that Yelon does not take shit from anyone, and he will do whatever he needs to do. Okay, so where do we go from here?
If we're trying to establish the fact that his son figures out exactly how crooked he really is when we don't need him to figure out that he murdered a kid. All he does is he goes up to his son and tells him not to fight. Yeah. He tells him to look him in the eye and not get in the ring, and tells him to be a coward and walk away.
Because it's all part of the plan.
Guillaume does that to his own son and sacrifices his own son, tells him to sacrifice his reputation and everything, and tells him to walk away. His son establishes right there that the fact that his dad's as corrupt as it comes. And, I mean, he already probably knew that there was some corruption. I mean, holy crap. The guy walks around with an entourage, and he's not a rapper. It's,
but does that make him corrupt? I mean, let's say the things that happened before
it
this.
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, he's a con man.
Okay, but he has a bet. The son knows it. Everybody knows it. All the boxers know it, because even the guy asked him, you can bet on it. And he goes, I already have. So he wants to win the bet. So, you know, this is just part of that bet. I don't think him telling his son to go up there and sit down, I think it is manipulation. I definitely agree it's manipulation. But I don't think that is a good thing to say. That's why he thinks his dad is a bad dude. I don't think that situation does that. His dad was trying to tell him why he was doing it, but he could have been better and a better explanation. Just to let you know, you not walking into the ring, not going inside the ring, doesn't count as a forfeit. I'm just having you go up there, look him in the eye, and then walk away to play with his mind.
But he's telling his son that I know you can't beat this guy.
No, I get that. And so it's a bad fatherly thing to do. It's bad, you know, in that sense. Yeah, it's crap. You know, it's a bad thing to do to the son after giving him a Corvette. But then the son bets the Corvette away. So the son's not the best son in the world either. I mean, he just takes a beautiful car and just gives it away, basically. But I don't think that situation makes him the most evil guy. Maybe to his son does, you know, because what he wants his dad's approval, right? And right now he thinks his dad thinks the worst of him. So if that's where we're going with it, I agree. But if we're saying that this is what makes him a bad guy, I'm not going to go with that. I don't think this makes him the bad guy. It's just part of the chess match. And he's right to do it. Palmer's in a frame of mind where he wants to go out there and annihilate everybody. And going up there and looking at him and walking away kind of changes the mental aspect of what Palmer's thinking. And then, you know, things change after that.
Palmer's justified in his rage.
Oh, most definitely he's justified in his rage. And that's why Guillaume does what he does, because he realizes he needs to get him out of that state of mind. Just like he put Hambone in his state of mind where he had to save his brother's life, you know, give it everything he got to try to save him. The state of mind for Palmer is changed too, because the circumstances have changed.
Yeah, and it's at that point the veil of the con is completely gone.
Not much veil left, though, right? I mean, let's be honest.
And so Guillaume finds out that one of the guys in town, the guy that's really set everything up, is an acquaintance of James Woods' character. But they don't kill him. They just put him in the hospital, which I would think that he would have, but that would have been a bigger thing than taking $5,000.
I agree. Maybe that should have been reversed.
And so it sets up the fact that Guillaume brings in this hammerhead, looks like cross between Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson, and he beats the shit out of Honey Ray Palmer. This is where it's almost unbelievable, the amount of punishment he takes. It's almost Rocky-esque. And James Woods is going to throw in the towel.
Oh, yeah. That's my biggest problem in this movie, is the towel thing. I hate the towel thing.
And he catches the towel and
throws
it back. I don't even know if the rules would have, because then all of a sudden they get technical after this fight, because he wins this fight because he after the towel's thrown in, and then he beats Hammerhead up and knocks him out.
Because now in boxing, all you have to do is wave the towel. And
right.
The
fight's over. Then all of a sudden it gets real technical because Gion's son never technically walked into the ring. Right. It sets up a really good moment at the end of the fights where Honey Ray Palmer doesn't even know the fact that the guy from the prison is essentially part of the con, which makes the whole fight at the beginning of the movie even more suspect. Was he setting up the warden? Because he figured out that the warden and Gion are friends and that he would have brought somebody like this in. But it is funny, though, when James Woods does the Caligula and puts the thumb down and tells Torres to take the dive. It's satisfying.
So is Torres out of jail just for the fight?
Yeah.
So he's going back to jail, right? Wouldn't there be repercussions?
But Gion doesn't have any power. He doesn't have any money to pay the warden off.
Right.
Let's be honest. The four or five guys that Gion has around him are just there because he has money and power.
Sure. The sheriff accountant. Yeah. But I mean, that box is going back to jail. And I assume he's going back to jail with money. Is that what
I'm sure that James Woods' character is going to take care of him.
Literally. Maybe
had to be established.
Probably, had his family take care of. So while you were talking, I looked it up, and there was an instance. Steve Gray, who is a referee of boxing, we've watched a number of Steve Gray's fight, and he was in a boxing match where the corner threw the towel, and the boxer did catch it and threw it out of the ring. And it's under the referee's discretion to honor.
Interesting.
I'm surprised to see that. I'm just reading it right now off of Matchroom Boxing.
That's wild.
So I guess it does happen. So I guess I don't have a bigger problem with it any longer. But at the time I watched it, I didn't really care for it.
It comes off very hokey.
Yeah.
It seems like it's something that's contrived for a movie.
Maybe something where he's about ready to throw it, and then maybe Fitz like stops him, like holds his hand, like, look, he's getting out, or something that stops him from throwing the towel. But I know why they do it, because they talk about Moline. And they talk about him throwing the towel. So we understand why they do it. Yeah, I agree with a little bit of the hookiness on it. As far as Hammerhead Hagen, I don't have a problem with him winning that fight, only because you have to figure that Hammerhead is probably also retired as well. He's in good shape, but it doesn't mean that he's in boxing shape.
He looks like he's 15 years younger than Honey Ray Palmer.
Well, but I don't know if that's the case or not.
And Palmer says, I thought you would be dead by now.
Well, he's 48 years old is Palmer. Palmer's 48. They talk about how old he is.
Right.
So if he lost twice to him, and let's just say it was
We know that he lost twice to him?
Yes. They talk about that in the...
I thought Honey Ray Palmer trained him.
No. They had two losses to the same guy. That's why I went and got him, because he lost to him once by decision and one by TKO.
When did they establish that?
When they were researching the records and stuff, they were looking in the books to find out the history of it.
But they never say the guy's name.
Even Woods says, you're Hammerhead Hagen? So Woods even knows who this guy is.
Well, that's what caused me to think that he trained him.
No, he didn't train him. So I'm thinking that this happened when he went in there in the early 30s, when he was about, I think of this as like 15 years ago. He probably retired him. And then that made him do the cash fighting. Because even they say earlier on, they say, and then he disappeared. Right. So that's how I buy that, is that he's not in boxing shape, that he's in physical shape, but he's not in boxing shape.
They should have got somebody that looked a little bit closer to Luis Casa Jr.'s age. Like I said, he looks like a cross between Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas.
Yeah. And he probably is younger. He probably is, I would say 40, because he's 48. That's what I'll say, roughly. He's probably also not boxing anymore. Because Gion doesn't have enough money for a good boxer to come to Digstown and pay him off. He doesn't have that kind of money.
The actor is definitely not.
No, he's not good at all.
The actor looks like he should have been in the ring. It's just kind of a weird dynamic. But
we don't know exactly how much money he's paid out to these guys overall, have
no,
we?
No, but it can't be that much. Because if you think about it, $5,000, $2,500 a piece to the other fighters were it, you got to think that these better fighters are not going to get a whole lot more. Because, first of all that money is invested in the bets anyway. And he seems like a cheapskate. when it comes to these type of things. So
that he does.
Well, and we established he's a racist too, so he probably was going to be a black guy anyway.
Guys are racist. You got the one guy from the bar. One of the boxers uses the N-word. Well,
that's Guillaume's son's friend.
He uses the N-word. But, yeah. And then you had that other guy.
But see, here again, he does say that in the ring, but then that's counteracted immediately by Louis Gossett Jr. spanking him, which is funny.
Funny thing about the ref in this movie.
Yeah, he was a real-life kickboxing world champion.
This was the first movie I ever saw him in, but I saw him in another movie with John Cusack. And him and John Cusack had a fight scene.
Point blank.
Gross point blank. Yep. Yeah.
Point blank.
Yes. When he's at the mini mart that used to be his house.
Yes. And then again, a reunion where he kills him with a pen.
Yes.
So, I don't know what other roles that guy's been in, but I just think it's interesting that the guy who's doing this is he's a martial artist. So that's
He's a real life badass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that he's keeping certain things away from even his partners. Even at the end here, he's not telling. He's got him protected. He's even conning him at the end that he's going to have to fight this last match.
Yeah, why doesn't he tell him in the corner? Because at this point in time, they witnessed a guy get murdered. The veil's gone at that point, and everybody knows that the con's on. And that they're just trying to out-con each other.
I think
so that's why they bring in Hammerhead.
Yeah, I think it's just the satisfaction of seeing Guillaume's face. Because he doesn't do it until he cheers. And he goes, and he goes, Manoso, and then he straightens out the tie, whistles and gives the thumbs up like Gion did. He kind of wanted to see the reaction.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think that's what makes the movie, it's that perfect ending right there. I think that is a perfect ending for this movie.
Yeah, it didn't really need to go the next steps. The reason I think it goes the next steps is to try to justify what they did a little while back. Because then we find out that, Guillaume then starts treating everybody like shit, kicks everybody out of the arena. He pulls
a sore loser.
Yeah. Well, yeah. He lost. He did lose everything.
Well, that's true.
I guess, quote unquote, his true colors come out. And of course, then he pulls the gun off of the sheriff and he's going to shoot Kane.
Well, like I said,
witnesses.
His son stops him.
Yeah.
But then here again,
it should have ended with him accidentally shooting his son.
Oh, I think that's too dark. That's even darker.
That is dark.
But we were dark.
But I think what's happened to his son up to this point.
The greatest lesson learned.
If we thought his son meant everything to him, I think that would be okay as an ending. Because that would hurt him the most. He's already been hurt the most already. Everything taken away from him is what hurts the most. That's why I don't know if him necessarily dying is the justification that we need. Would we like to see that? Of course, to a certain extent, we do. But he is going to suffer the rest of his life being shown that he lost to Kane.
Then, okay, that's fine. We don't need the Elder Busby knocking him out.
That makes sense if his brother got beat up.
Right.
Like maybe
it's a little
outside,
ridiculous.
Maybe he left and he accidentally outside gets hit by a car but doesn't die or something to that extent.
Or
right?
he walks outside to get in his car and Busby attacks him. The way it's set up is kind of hokey. That's my biggest problem. The things don't equal out. All of a sudden, the Elder Busby's, he's avenged his brother's death by punching Guillaume in the face and knocking him into a bunch of popcorn.
That corny 90s ending. Wah, wah, wah.
I think the problem with all that is the fact that they really just didn't know how to get that character to go crazy like that, to try to like take out Palmer. Because everybody that's fighting really doesn't have a stake. I mean, he's already got a bribe.
Kidnapped him.
But I understand they kidnapped him. But what are they going to do with him? So I think that once you have him kidnapped, you kind of put yourself in a corner. What's going to happen? And I think
he gets a call from the hospital.
Maybe it's a threat that we will kill him, but they don't actually kill him. It's a threat of killing him, but beating him, to an inch of his life. Again, like I said earlier, maybe we switch it. Maybe they, inch of his life for him, but the other guy who gets stuck in the locker, he's actually
dead. Who dies?
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense, and it's a lot more justified.
Right. It's easy for us to say, 30 years later, how that should have worked out. But overall, I think the movie ends well. I love throughout the whole movie, Kane is trying to give Palmer motivational speeches and stuff like that. You know, so, you know, and some of them come off being a little bit, a tad racist, a little bit, you know, hey, these guys haven't gone 20 something rounds already tonight, but remember, you're black. And then he's like, right. I'm trying to do this roots thing here and stuff like that. He's like, well, you're a shitty motivator.
And that's funny because Louis Gossett Jr. was actually in Roots.
Right, exactly. But then, of course, at the end, he goes, yeah, what you did couldn't be done. And then he goes, now you motivate me. And it's kind of a nice line to end on the movie. And it has that little kind of 90s type of outro music to end
the movie. Oh, the music here is horrible.
The music kind of sounds like a TV show, how a TV show would end the
very
music,
much
right?
So. Except for the Alabama songs that were playing in the bar and stuff.
I was surprised they got away with playing a song like that. You know, if your whole movie is not going to be playing music like that, how are you going to use one song? It does what it needs to do. It's got enough twists and turns here and there to kind of keep us interested. I understand one of the turns went kind of dark and maybe that it shouldn't have gone that area. But in general, I think the movie does a good job of keeping us interested in the movie.
All right. Well, let's talk about the reviews. This movie, we'll kick it off with Ted.
Just finding a critic that I could actually align with was kind of difficult. And I don't really necessarily agree with everything that Marjorie Baumgarten from the Austin Chronicle had to say. The blurb that I took from her review was, considering the talents involved in this project, it's hard to imagine that it would turn out to have anything less than competent workmanship. But it doesn't rise above the bare minimum standard or contribute anything that's not at least a bit derivative or commonplace. The movie is Rocky meets The Sting by way of some Raging Bulls fight choreography. I don't necessarily agree 100% with everything she says here. I do think that the Rocky meets The Sting by the way of Raging Bulls fight choreography is actually pretty correct, because I think a lot of the fight sequences for movies are pretty believable. Overall, I like the movie. I like the cast. I think the cast is amazing here. I think that it's here again. I think the failings are in the writing. A lot of the critics that I read the reviews of really blamed the director for a lot of the reason that they didn't like the movie. I don't think that necessarily it was the director's fault. As far as the movie being kind of just mediocre, I think I like the fact that it's not color by numbers either. It has different takes on different things, and I do like the chemistry here. So I think that's part of the, not only just the cast, but I think the director as well. It's the writing that just kind of is all over the place. Like I established, I believe that it decided to go way too dark in the middle of a movie that wasn't totally dark. It didn't need to go where it went. Overall, does it affect my review of the movie? I mean, it's uncomfortable. Yeah. It made me uncomfortable. Both times I watched it this week, I didn't care for it. But the movie itself, I will give the movie itself 3 hooks. It's a movie that I might watch again. If I watch it, it would be for the fight sequences. The rest of the movie is just, it's kind of hokey. But here again, I don't hold the cast or the director accountable here. Like with a few of the movies that we've reviewed, I blame the writer. The writer failed in quite a few places here and tried to be too cute, in my opinion. So I'm going to go with 3 hooks.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll give my review of this movie. This is a fun movie. And my review that I am aligning with, New York Times. It's a toughie. I'm not sure who the article is written by, but I'm going to read just the first paragraph of it here. It's not since Smile and Semi-Tough, both released in the mid-1970s, has Michael Ritchie directed anything quite as entertaining as Digstown, a funny and vulgar fable about con artists so cynical that signs of simple skepticism can be taken for religious epiphanies. I think that sums the movie up pretty good. It's a hokey movie, let's be honest. The writing is not great. But it's a fun movie. I mean, I really enjoyed watching this movie, and I watched this movie twice, and it got better the second time I watched it. I caught a few things that I didn't catch the first time. I mean, it's not The Godfather. It's not The Sting, clearly. You know, it's not Shawshank, but it's a fun con movie. It's got its moments. It's a little predictable. It's a little cheesy. It's a little hokey, but it's enjoyable. Yeah, it's got a few scenes in there that maybe don't need to be there, but you know what movie doesn't? I'm going to agree with Ted on this one. This is a solid 3 hooks for me. Hopefully, if you are listening to this podcast, you'll check this movie out, because it's obviously not on everyone's radar, as it didn't do very good at the box office. Ken, take us home. What do you got?
First of all, I'll say that if you do want to watch this movie, it is free on Prime Video right now, so you should be able to check
it out. Exactly where I watched it. Yep.
I actually own this movie. It's one of my favorite guilty pleasures. I'm going to line, though, with David Anson from Newsweek. He said, give credit where credit is due. Richie and screenwriter Stephen McKay know how to turn their crowd-pleasing tricks. It's one sucker punch after another, but you have to be a rock not to fall for it. So it's kind of like opposite of what Ted was saying there. So they kind of actually enjoyed the screenwriting on this. And I call it a guilty pleasure, though it's not a bad rated movie. It's not certified fresh, but it is fresh. It does have it has a decent audience score. I like the acting here. I do like the twists and turns. For whatever reason, this movie hit me at the right time in the 90s. I actually saw this movie before I saw The Sting, amazingly enough. And The Sting is one of my favorite movies of all time. This is not The Sting. However, whenever I put this movie on, I enjoy it and I have to watch it from beginning to end. This is not a movie that I usually watch in the middle or anything. Like, this is a movie I start from beginning to end. I look forward to seeing this movie.
It doesn't come up on cable TV very often, does it?
Not anymore. Back in the day, it came up a lot. Definitely not as much as it used to. But I really do enjoy this flick. I agree that there's, you know, certain scenes I can do without. There are certain characters that really, really don't mean anything. You know, Heather Graham is here for eye candy, and she's a great actress, don't get me wrong. But she really is here for just to look at, because she really doesn't serve much into the plot. I think James Woods and Louis Gossett Jr. and Bruce Dern do a great job feeding off each other. Oliver Platt does a really good job at, you know, in this as well. This is a hard one for me to grade, because I know it's not a 5-star movie. And I understand why you guys went with 3. And your guys are not going to understand why I do this. I'm giving this movie 4.5 hooks. It's 4.5 hooks for me because it's one of my favorite movies to go to every single time. This movie, it would be really weird if I don't watch at least a couple times a year.
That's what I give Draft Day.
And that we all have our movies like that. We all have our movies. So this movie for me, like, if you were to look at my top 10 movies of all time, you're like, I get that. And I'm not saying Dick Sounds in my top 10, probably in my top 20. But if you looked at my top 20, you'd probably like, I get that. And you'd be like, Dickstown? Top 20?
Never heard of it.
We all have those movies. And Dickstown is one of those movies that just does it for me. So yes, 4.5 hooks.
I mean, we can agree it's a good boxing movie, right?
I think that's the other thing is I think it's an underrated boxing film. I think, like Ted had stated earlier, you know, boxing is really well done. I mean, whoever they brought in to do the choreography did a great job. And
yeah, these guys took some real hits.
And yeah, it looks like these guys are taking it. I mean, I don't see many throws that didn't hit. I mean, I'm sure if I really, really tried, I could find them. And the fact that these guys look like they were trained to do a good job. So
whoever trained them to pull their punches, because I'm sure that I'm sure accidents happen.
Yeah.
But Ric Flair used to do, Ric Flair being pro wrestler, what he would do to perfect his pulled punch was he would tie a string from the top of a doorway and he would punch so that the string never moved. It probably didn't go to that extent, but their punches are believable. A lot more, like Ken said, a lot more believable than a couple of the Rocky movies where it's pretty obvious that no contact is made. You know, you're never going to be able to get a perfect boxing movie where the damage done is equal to the punishment that's being perpetrated in the ring. I mean, because let's face it, Louis Gossett Jr.'s face and body would have been a mess after 10 fights.
Mm-hmm.
Especially after coupled the big tank guy and then Hammerhead. I mean, they worked him over pretty hard.
I mean, it does look pretty bad by the last fight. He does look,
yeah,
not, maybe not as does, bad as he should. I mean, maybe a little bit better. we shouldn't be looking like Rocky and Apollo Creed at the end of Rocky One, where Rocky's face right. looks like the Elephant Man.
It's a little ridiculous too.
But it's really well done. I don't know if I'll say it's the best boxing movie for me for boxing. I'm a big fan of Cinderella Man when it comes to love how that is shot. That's where we're going to go with our reviews for Dickstown.
So Ted, what is the next movie we are doing?
In honor of May the 4th be with you, we're going to start the prequel trilogy of Star Wars movies, starting with Episode 1, The Phantom Menace.
So the crummy ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These are the bad CG ones. I know the ones we're talking about.
These are the ones that caused problems.
We know.
Are you kidding me? These are the best written ones that ever was ever written.
Sure.
Yeah. Ted's a big Star Wars nut. And I mean, we're like really big. I haven't seen The Phantom Menace in at least 2 or 3 years. I always sat down and I watched all of them when they started, you know, when George Lucas sold his soul and they started making all the new ones. So I started watching some of the old ones to get back into them. Sweet. All right. Phantom Menace. Why not? Let's do it.
It's not as bad as the second one. So we'll
is that Attack of the Clowns?
Yeah, exactly.
I agree. Send in the clowns. All right. Well, Ted, where can they find us on the World Wide Web?
We can be found on Twitter at @HookedOn_movies. Come on and you tell us what you think of Digstown, or tell us what you think of The Phantom Menace. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of opinions as to how people want to either attack or love The Phantom Menace. But whatever podcast version you're listening to us on, whether it be GoodPod, Apple, Spotify, if you can, leave us a 5-star rating or review. If you leave a review, tell us what you think of Digstown. It helps us get noticed.
Cool. And what's going on Facebook, Ken?
Oh, just go ahead and join our Facebook page, Hooked on Movies. You right there, you can get into discussions about movies that you like or movies that we reviewed, or maybe they're both. So just go ahead and send us a request to join our page, and you'll be accepted because we're desperate.
And we appreciate you all out there listening.
If you give us money, we'd make a whole lot more and quit our jobs. But just
maybe.
Eric would want to do that. So
It's going to take a lot of donations.
You might buy a Corvette, though.
I might.
A Corvette, yeah.
A little Matchbox Corvette, about yay big. Yay big. Well, that's all the time we have on this episode of Hooked on Movies. As always, I'm changing my line to God help us. Or no, you know what? Change my line to God save the queen. That's going to be my line. God save the queen. Yes.
See you at the movies.
See you next time on Hooked on Movies.